You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Lily Ledbetter. Her name may be familiar to you because she is a champion of equal pay for equal work, which is something she fought for as a woman, but which also extends to discrimination on the basis of race or any other reason. She wrote a memoir called Grace and Grit, My Fight for Equal Pay and Fairness at Goodyear and Beyond. And it's a wonderful read because it gives us such an insight into who she is as a person, who she was as a young person, and how she went about fighting and ultimately winning. All that in just a moment. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lanl Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. It's a real honor today to welcome Lily Ledbetter. She's a longtime fighter for the cause of equal pay for equal work. She worked for almost 20 years at Goodyear Tire Company in Alabama, where she was often treated poorly because of her sex. She was the object of harassment, exclusion, vandalism, and unequal pay, which she found out only because someone left her an anonymous note one day with her salary and those of her male counterparts. That led to a lawsuit against Goodyear and a Supreme Court case, and then the Lily Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which was the first law signed by President Obama in 2009. Lily Ledbetter will be in Santa Fe on Tuesday, April 2nd, thanks to the Santa Fe chapter of the AAUW. To get tickets, put AAUW Santa Fe into your search engine, and you will find them there. Welcome, Lily Ledbetter, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. I just read your wonderful memoir, Grace and Grit, which I recommend to everybody. You grew up in a small town in Alabama, and from the earliest age, it seems that you really knew your own mind and wouldn't be pushed around. You married at 17, and as you write, you wouldn't stand for being tricked, manipulated, dominated. What do you think was the source of your strength?
I think having the background and seeing my parents struggle, and I was an only child, and I was taught early in life a good work ethic, that if I worked, I had to do a good day's work. So I think all of my background together, and my mother was a strong woman, and she was real hard, I thought, while I was growing up, but I learned later in life that prepared me for what life was all about.
Right, right. So you had children young, and when they were in school, at a certain point, you decided to go back to work, very much for economic reasons. At first, your husband was against it. He was kind of a traditionalist, but then he came around. Describe that period of your life for us a little bit, and how you found your talents, prodigious talents, as a worker and a manager.
Well, I knew that I needed to go back to work because we needed the money. And it was hard during those years. There was not a lot of jobs that women could get. They were bankers, teachers, secretaries, nurses, whatever field, but they were considered women's jobs, which I hate that reference, but because I feel like they're all jobs. But it was very hard, and it was hard to convince my husband that I needed to go to work. So he got the message, because when I did, I was already really working a job, and I would separate my money into a separate checking account. It didn't take him long to understand, yes, we need your income. So he got on later on board, and he would always offer, what could he do to help me?
And then you were able to do things like buy a house, and you rose very quickly. I mean, you started at H&R Block as a tax preparer, and pretty soon you were overseeing a lot of people. You just, I guess, had kind of a natural ability as a manager.
I believe that's born in people, and if you can get along with people and you work with people, like I would tell the guys and gals, Goodyear, they didn't have to like me because a lot of the men resented having to report to a female. But I said, you do not have to like me, but you must respect the job I hold, and I will never lie to you, and we'll get along fine. So I never really had any major problems with them. And the people with H&R Block operation, you had to sort of have like a team effort. You had to go in. Everybody had to work together to be successful. And a company like that one, they made their net profit in just so many days a year. So it was critical that everybody on the team worked together.
You began at Goodyear Tire in 1979 in a managerial role. You were a supervisor, and you were excited to be working and paving the way for women managers and having a good and decently paid job. But it didn't really play out as you'd hoped. You endured, really from the beginning, all kinds of harassment. Describe for us some of the things that your coworkers did, your male coworkers did and said.
Well, Darren, that particular time, the company was realizing that they needed more women in top key positions. So most any female they'd hired, they were looking to promote. And I think my male counterpart sort of was afraid that I would be the one in line for a promotion. So I got a lot of things done to my, like I would go in for my shift and I'd be left without stock for continuous operation because it didn't shut down from one shift to the other. The machinery kept running, the items kept being produced, and I'd get to work and I wouldn't have enough stock. I wouldn't have enough people. Somebody reported off, but no one on the off-going shift would have called in me any overtime. So I started going to work 2 hours early so I could see who had reported off and check my floor to see what materials I had and didn't have. And a lot of the union people respected me because I treated them with dignity and what they deserved. And some of them would come in a little early and start making sure also that I had the stock I needed. So that I was always grateful to all the union men and women.
Very interesting. So the union people really treated you better than the other managers. Is that right?
That's correct. I had a few people but what I liked about the union men and women, and mostly men, they would tell me, you know, I just don't like working for a woman. And I'd say, well, there's not any difference. All I do is give you your schedule, make sure you're paid correct, make sure you have the material you need, and schedule vacation, and we do our housekeeping and our work together, and we're successful, then you're successful, and so am I. But if we mess up, we're both in it together, and we have to correct it and do better next day. So I had respect from the union. Yes, they respected it. They respected it, and I didn't lie to them. If there was, I didn't always exactly tell them the whole truth sometimes, but I'd tell them as much as I could, and I never lied to them because if a certain thing was coming down and I was told not to tell it, I just didn't say anything. But if I could, I told them. So I was always honest, and I treated them fair. And I worked extremely hard. I was always available, too. I didn't go missing on my shift. So I had a big area to cover, and I respected. And those men were paid really well, working for Goodyear and in a union. And I knew if they was capable, and most of the men that I had working in my department, in one case, I had almost 50% of them had college degrees. And I said, why are you working at Goodyear? And the guy said, well, I've got good pay, really good benefits. He said, in fact, my pay is better than teaching and coaching. So that's why he was at Goodyear.
Very interesting. Meanwhile, you describe in the book a whole world of sexual harassment, vandalism. I mean, somebody cut some gear pieces in your car in a way that could have killed you if you'd had a car, you know, could have caused a car accident. You were lucky that it didn't. You describe being yelled at for something like a solid hour by a manager named Stan, and he was red in the face and veins bulging out of his neck. You handled this and so many other incidents of that kind, and you were really the only woman who survived in your position for a long period of time. How did you manage it? How did you survive, like, emotionally and every other way?
Emotionally, a manager, when they go in, anyone, no matter what you're managing, a small two- or three-person store or a tax preparation of 16 offices or a tire plant, different sections, you have to be tough. You have to be strong. And anything that is said back and forth is not personal. You just cannot take it personal. You just have to let it slide off your back. And I always looked at people, and if they was yelling at me or whatever, I just would try to respond if I could, try to talk them down. Sometimes I've had to agree with them so that they would back off, so that it did not go any farther. But a lot of that, what you're speaking about that happened to my cars, was out in the parking lot. And of course, I wasn't out there when the violence occurred, but I did talk to the company officials, and I finally got the approval that I could park my car inside the gate right next to the guardhouse. So in the last months and last year I worked, I didn't have that vandalism on my car that I had to worry about. But I had a variety of items that happened to the car, and I can't tell you who would have done it because I have no idea.
Right, right.
It was just somebody that wanted me to leave Goodyear, wanted me to throw up my hands and quit and say, I can't take this and go on. But that's just not who I was, and you've got to be strong. And I had a reason. I was working. I was working for my family like every other American citizen does. They don't go to work because it's a game or it's fun. Now, if you've got a job you enjoy, that's great. But I was there working because I had two children in college. I was paying car payments. I was paying the house mortgage. And we still had lots of bills to pay, as a family does in middle-class America.
Right.
That's why I couldn't quit, because I continued to work, because it was just to pay the bills.
Now, the kinds of problems you faced as a woman, did you feel that Black workers at Goodyear were facing similar kinds of hostility on the basis of race?
Absolutely. Yes. It appeared, and I don't need no lawsuit on this, but this is my opinion, what I saw and what I observed. There were very few women and definitely very few African Americans. And most of the African Americans that had college degrees and was in a managerial position, a lot of times they would get another job and leave. They wouldn't stay because it was not, the atmosphere was just not good for either one, women or African Americans. And when I went to trial, I had the only other African American manager at Goodyear that had the same position I did, sitting out in the courtroom hallway waiting to testify on my behalf because he had the same treatment. He had never been treated fairly and equitably either. And notice that there was only one, too. They just didn't have many African Americans. Actually, the union men told me that they were not allowed, the African Americans, to have any other job other than like cleaning, like toilets and maintenance and stuff like that, until after they got a union.
Now, your philosophy was that if you worked harder and smarter than your male counterparts, you would eventually be recognized. And you described, you know, coming in 2 hours early and really making sure that everything was going to go right during your shift. But it didn't work out that way. You were actively sabotaged to the point where they'd make false reports to try to demonstrate that your performance was poor, when actually it was superior and you won a performance award. And then on top of that, you found out that somebody left you an anonymous note, and you found out that they were paying you considerably less than your male counterparts who'd started at the same time and were doing the same work. What did you do next?
When I saw that note, I was devastated, humiliated, and I just didn't see how I could go face the people for a 12-hour shift. But Then again, I did not know where that information came from, how many people in management knows this. But anyway, I had to go to work. I could not quit and come home. I couldn't be sick and come home. I had to stay and do my shift. So I worked my shift, and I thought about immediately the overtime pay, because I had just come off working 2 months straight, 7 nights a week, 12-hour shifts. That's a lot of time and half, double and triple. That's a lot of money, even on my low pay. And I had lost that. I thought about that, and it just was so heart-wrenching to know how hard I'd worked and how many hours and how hard it'd been and what I had to do to accomplish that. And then the next thing I thought about was my retirement. It's based on what I'm earning, and my contributory retirement is based on what I'm earning. My 401k was 10% of my earnings, matched my 6% stock, and my Social Security today is based on what I earned. And I just couldn't let it go. But I did not stay and go to see a superior or an HR manager the next morning, because I'd already been that route. My immediate superior, when I met with him on a scheduled interview to talk about how I stood and how I could get my pay up before retirement, he told me I was listening to too much BS from the men. So when I saw that note, and it had Lily and three men, and they were making 40% more than I was, I couldn't let it go. I thought about it. It eat at me all night. I got my shift finished. I came home and explained to my husband, I must file a charge with the Equal Employment Commission unless you object. And I will warn you, if I start, we'll be in this for 8 years. So he drove me to Birmingham. I was off that morning. I'd worked out. We went to Birmingham, and the interviewer I got with Equal Employment Commission, they drug out of me every detail about my experience at Goodyear. I was with her for over 3 hours. When I got up to leave, she said, "These folks have been messing with you for a long time." And I realized it that day more than I ever had. I just had never really accepted how bad it was, because, like I said, I couldn't afford to quit. And by the time you're in your late 40s and early 50s, it's hard to get a really good job. So I just did not quit. Another thing Goodyear tries to argue today, that I was a very poor performer. That's why my pay was so low. But in the early 90s, they handpicked me to be one of the managers to start up the light truck radio division in Gadsden, Alabama. And then I got that top performance award later. But my boss said at trial that was just to try to get my pay within reason of what the others were making, that he saw how low my pay was. So there are a lot of things wrong with all that. And also, they keep saying today that I was a poor performer. But you have to realize I was in a managerial position. State of Alabama is an at-will state. All they had to do was say, "Lily, we don't need you. Lily, go home. Don't come back." Without a reason. They did not have to give me a reason, but I stayed from the time I went to work in February of 79 until I left November of 98.
Now, some of our listeners might know that you won your anti-discrimination case in Alabama against Goodyear, and you were awarded a large sum of money in back pay and damages, but that decision was overturned on appeal. It then went to the Supreme Court, where you lost 5-4, five-member conservative majority, and the winning argument was, I mean, it's unbelievable to me, probably to most rational people. The winning argument was that you should have brought the case when the discrimination first occurred, even though you didn't know that it had occurred until years later.
That's true. A little bit on that. The law had always been interpreted based on paycheck accrual rule, which meant if you were still getting a check and filed a charge and you won an amount, you were entitled to it because you filed within that 180-day period. Well, I didn't know that I was being underpaid. I tried to find out, but just like my boss said, I was listening to too much BS, tried to turn it off that I was okay, which I knew I wasn't, but I couldn't get anything done. But I couldn't. I worked for a corporation that said if you discuss your pay, you won't work here. So no one ever talked about their pay to me, and I never talked about mine to them because I couldn't find out. I couldn't afford to lose my job, neither could they. So I never had any way to know what other people were getting raises, when they got a raise, or if mine was in line, or how I even rated. No one ever bothered to tell me that I was maybe bottom or next to bottom. They didn't tell me that. So I couldn't do anything about what I didn't know. And also, the argument against the Ledbetter bill, people were saying, oh, people would just save it up for a big payout. Well, that is not a big payout because on back pay, you can only go back 2 years. I don't care if you work, like me, 30 years. You can only go back 2 years. That's all they give you on back pay. And the judge gave me $30,000 per year, and he did not take into consideration any overtime, no retirements, no adjustments for them. The jury did. That's why the big verdict. But in the end, I lost it all. I didn't get a dime. But people are that like myself, when we're working, we're like I said, we're working for our families. We need our money now because we're raising our families, and we need to save for future retirements so we can support ourselves into retirement. But we don't want a gift, but we want what we're entitled to.
So then after the Supreme Court case, there was an action by Congress when Obama was elected. A law was passed just barely over a week into his first term that has your name on it. Tell us that story.
Oh, that story is a wonderful story. I just pinch myself sometimes thinking that it's almost unbelievable because we had worked on the bill immediately starting after the verdict came out in my case because Justice Ginsburg, she challenged Congress to take the ball up. She said, this is in your court. Now it's time for you to change this grave injustice back. It was critical that that law be changed back, and Congress could. So they immediately started working on it. The first time it went through the Senate for a vote, it came up a little short, and then it was voted on again the next year. It already passed the House, and in 2009, you're right, it was voted on right after the president took office. And it passed in the Senate that time, and that was the first law that the president signed. And I've never been so humbled and so grateful. It didn't mean a thing to Lilly Ledbetter other than the honor that it bestowed upon me and the obligation I feel to share my story because it is so critical across this nation. There's so many women like myself who I've now lived 10 years without my husband. He died in 2008. He never lived to see the bill become law. He knew that it would, but he didn't live. He had cancer that we were going through. That was 2 years right before he passed, and it was really hard because, you know, cancer treatment and the gas was so high then to get to the for treatment. It was really hard, but we persevered, and he stuck with me. My family supported me, and we got the bill passed. And that's a record. That bill passed in 18 months in Washington. And the thing that I am so proud of, it was co-sponsored by Democrats as well as Republicans and maybe an independent. And also, it was passed into law by both parties. Because when I talked about equal pay walking the halls of Congress, equal pay is an American right. That belongs to everybody. It touches every household some way across this nation.
And because of this act, people who went through, women who went through, whoever was discriminated against, who went through what you did at Goodyear, would be able to recover damages. Is that correct?
That's correct. They can file a charge. Now, it's not a slam dunk because there's a lot to getting a case like this. You file your charge, they approve you. And the reason I had a lawyer separate from the Equal Employment Commission was simply because they were backlogged and short of help during that time. And they advised me, they said, you've got a great case. If you'll get your own attorney, you might get to trial faster. Well, I found a firm in Birmingham, Alabama, with an attorney named John Goldfarb, and he took my case on a contingent basis. That firm has $500,000, I'm told, in my case, and they never got a dime because had I won, they would have gotten half of what I got. But and that was fine with me because at that point in time of my life, it was about what was right. It was not so much about the money, although I would be living a little bit easier today if I had gotten some increase in my retirement and my income, because it is extremely hard to be a widow and to stay self-independent after you lose your spouse. And there are so many women across this nation that live in their children's homes because they cannot stay independent, and they may have worked 30, 35 years as a nurse, a teacher, secretary, whatever, but they did not get enough income to save for retirement, and they did not get enough income to afford the Social Security to help them. It's a shame in this country, and what I hate about it, this country is we have resources, we have education, we're better than this.
Yeah. Now, in the 10 years since this law was passed, have you seen how it has helped women who were facing similar kinds of discrimination to what you faced at Goodyear? In other words, have there been successful cases because of this law that you've witnessed?
Yes, it was a long time that the region here that I live in, the Equal Employment Commission, would send me notices every time they won a big case like this, similar to mine. And I don't get those anymore. I just have to try to research and keep up. But what I really liked was when a lot of the people would grab me and hug me when they'd get to meet me and say, oh, I just can't thank you enough. One lady in New York who is a lawyer, a very professional person, told me that she got enough money from her employer. She would never have to work again. But she said, I'm still working because I love my job. I'm good at it. And now I get the earnings that I'm really entitled to. And all she did was present to her employer what she knew that she was being underpaid. So many other cases across this nation, people have told me that, stories like that, and they've gotten money without ever going to trial. And most employers, they do not like a lot of negative publicity. The company that I work for has gotten an awful lot of negative publicity because of the treatment that they've done to women and minorities. And they still, I'm not sure they've changed completely today, but you have to treat people fairly and equitably, and you have to be a successful company, you must adhere to the law. You must. And the companies who are doing that, I've seen a lot of companies change their policies and their procedures, and that's what I hoped for most. We don't want a lot of lawsuits. That's the last thing anybody wants because, see, I spent 9 years of my life. I filed my charge in 98. I got the final verdict in 2007. I spent another 18 months walking the halls and the streets of Washington, D.C., halls of Congress, and then the city, NPR, everything I could do to get the notice out, to get the law changed, because it was so critical. If we had not got that law changed, that would have meant that a young female or minority got a job, they start your pay, and if you're not told and know exactly how you stand, you could be right then starting your unequal pay, which would give you 6 months to file a charge. Most people have not learned all of the details or their new job thoroughly. And if it's a large building, large operation like I worked in, I don't think I even knew where all the bathrooms were in 6 months. So it's not something that people dwell on. It's something that you just want to make sure that you are being treated fairly and equitably. And these companies like Salesforce, their people know they will be evaluated every year and they will be paid according to their work and what they're entitled to. And that's all people expect. They don't expect a gift or special treatment. They just want to know. And when you have employees that know this, they will come to work with more enthusiasm, more energy, and give 110% to more, whereas if they're doubtful, they'll be grumbling, they may stay out, they may be late getting there, and when they're there, they're not as productive. You want people that's on board with your company to make you successful, and the net profit as great as it can be.
When you look at the kind of discrimination that you endured, and I mean, reading about it in your book, it's clear that the men who harassed you were so emotional, they were so irrationally angry at the very idea that a woman would be their equal. How do you understand that kind of crazy rage? What do you think is the source of it?
A lot of the coworkers I had in management had just gotten promoted from being a union member to management, and I don't think they had the training or the education in their background to understand how to deal with it. But they were so afraid that I was going to be promoted. And every female that Goodyear that I know about that they had, they didn't stay long enough to get a lot of those promotions. And if they did, one lady finally got promoted. She got promoted to being a plant manager, but she later left. And I understand now she is a lawyer out in Oklahoma. Then there was another lady they hired that had graduated at West Point. And their goal for her, the rumor was that she would be the first female plant manager. She went to another factory from Gadsden. She trained there, and then she went to another one. And then she went out to another older union factory, and the men managers, her coworkers, blamed her with a problem with the union. She, of course, got another job and left. Those are your choices. And had I been younger, back when all that started with me, I would have left too. But I was about, I think, 38, close to 39 when I went to work with Goodyear, and I did not intend on leaving.
Now, it was a very stressful work, and it took a real toll on your health and, to some extent, your family. And as you said, your beloved husband died in 2008, just before the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act passed. It's been about 10 years since then. What have the last 10 years been like for you?
The last 10 years have been hard because, like I said, it's hard to... I still live in the home that he and I had lived in. We had been married for 53 years when he passed. We got married young. I still live in our house, and it's an old house, of course. It was built when we bought it. It had been built in the late 50s, so it's a lot of maintenance, a lot to keep up, and it's about all I can do but to keep it up. But the joys of being able to travel, like this will be my first trip in New Mexico. And Jenny, who talked with me, we talked about it. What a great time I had. The first time I came and she met me, that was the first time I'd ever been to New Mexico. I went into Albuquerque, and I worked for a group over there, and then went up to Los Alamos. And they treated me great and gave me a tour while I was out there. So I've been able to travel the world and talk to people. And when people recognize me in the airport and tap me on the shoulder and they'll say, "Are you the Lilly Ledbetter?" And I said, "That's me." And they start telling me how much my story has meant to them, how they've gotten new jobs. Or one lady worked for a manufacturer in Mississippi, and she went in and presented her case to her superior. And she hadn't worked for the company, I don't think, a long time. But they gave her a check for $125,000 to make up the difference. And she said, "Well, I believe I'll resign." So she quit and went back to college. She liked 2 years. So she finished her education with that. But they were simply mispaying her. And those are the stories that just make my life so wonderful. The first invitation I had after the bill was passed in Washington and signed into law, the Rome Ministries invited me to Rome, Italy. My Washington attorney and I traveled to Rome, Italy to share my story and to talk about my case. And that was one of the most exciting times. And I've been out of the country once since then talking about the Ledbetter story and the Ledbetter bill. But I've been all over this United States, some places many times, I've been in every state, I think, except two, and some of them many times and all over the state. So it's been a joy to know that I have helped so many people. In fact, I told my pastor that at my funeral, I'd like the last statement he'd make that I made a difference. Because if I had known exactly how bad my situation was in my income and how desperate this would have been for the rest of my life, I would probably been at Equal Employment Commission's door, banging on the door to find out what I could do to make those people help me with my income before I retired. Because, see, I worked for a corporation that had government contracts from the day I went to work until the day I left. So my thinking would be that surely for this company to get these major, major contracts, and they had more than one, sometimes they'd have several even in Gadsden, they have to be getting audited and checks to make sure that they're adhering to federal laws and guidelines. But to my sorrow, they did not. Nobody checked them. It was just who sold the bill of goods on who should have the contracts between the different rubber companies. There was no checks and no balances, but President Obama signed a bill in April of 2014 that would require people who got government contracts. Now, I believe New Mexico has a law, something similar to that in the state, that if you have a contract, you will adhere to federal and state laws or you will not work that contract in that state. A lot of the states have their own contracts, of their own laws now about contracts, and they should be, because Goodyear Gadsden should never have had all those major contracts. And I just knew that I knew I wasn't getting paid exactly what the men were, but I thought, sure, I was close. And equal pay don't mean you get dollar for dollar. He gets a dollar, you get a dollar. It can be a little different based on experience and years and so forth. There's things that can change it and make a difference. But this was too far apart.
The way you see it, Goodyear really hasn't made a lot of improvements. Is that right?
That's what some of the people tell me, but I don't know much about their operation anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't know anyone that's still working.
Right. I wanted to ask you, how do your children and grandchildren feel about the work you've done?
They're very proud of me. They're very proud of my three oldest grandchildren, and my daughter's whole family went with me to the White House for the bill signing. And all three of my oldest grandchildren, they've made trips with me. In fact, my middle grandson, he flew into Washington one December, and I met him up there at the airport. He and I had us a driver. He and the driver carried us to the White House, and I had an invitation to the Christmas reception, and he and I went to the reception. And then we go back to the airport, and we fly back home to Alabama. And then the oldest one, he was in college. He went to Harvard with me. I was invited to go to Harvard Law School to speak, and he made the trip to Harvard with me. And then the youngest one, he went on a trip to New York. And they were all spaced out. And when I got my honorary doctorate of law degree from the City University of New York. So it's been a great journey. And they've been on many trips. They've been on several others. And they always watch a TV show if I'm going to be on. And so it's really been a great journey. And they've been right there with me. So I'm proud of my family.
Lily Ledbetter, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to seeing you here in Santa Fe.
thank you for having me. Thank you very much for telling my story, because, and I hope it makes a difference in somebody's life. Maybe somebody will hear the story and say, that's me, or that's my mom, or that's my daughter, and they can pass that story along and make a difference in somebody's life.
And once again, Lily Ledbetter will be in Santa Fe on Tuesday, the 2nd of April, thanks to the Santa Fe chapter of the AAUW. To get tickets, put AAUW Santa Fe into your search engine, and you will find it. The website is santafe-nm.aauw.net. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood support and partnerships, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks LANL Foundation for their sponsorship of this program. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.